Welcome to Authors of the Pacific Northwest, where we connect Pacific Northwest authors with new listeners and provide advice for aspiring authors on the business of writing. I'm your host, Vicki J. Carter.
So hi there, podcast listeners. Thank you so much for coming back to the podcast today. I have an amazing author that I was introduced to from another author that has recently been on the podcast or will be on the podcast. Her name is JD Jones. So JD, how about you say hi to everybody?
Hi, everybody.
Awesome. So JD, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and start out with telling us what state you live in the Pacific Northwest?
I live in Southern Oregon in the Grants Pass area. So a little south of the town of Grants Pass.
Yeah, I know the area well. My oldest daughter is right now in Roseburg, Oregon. But they're moving back up this way. So I'm kind of not super familiar with that Grants Pass area, but I've been down that way.
It's very rural. I mean, it's like this little spot of city, sort of city, in a lot of rural. So not a whole lot to see.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize the Pacific Northwest is a lot of rural areas. So it's like
it's been wonderful. But we moved here from Georgia. Sorry, we moved here from Georgia 2 years ago, and it's really different. But it's the way I want to raise my kids. So it's been a learning curve and definitely a new culture. But we like it a lot.
Awesome. So we'll get into a little bit about. You know, your transplant history here, because I think it'll go into my next question. So you're an author, a published author, and we'll talk about what you publish and what your works are in a minute. But do you have a day job or something else you do besides being an author? And if so, share with our listeners what that is.
Sure. Well, I have three small kids. They are 2, 3, and 7. And, you don't want to call motherhood a job, but
it is.
and then we live on a horse farm. And what we do is we look for mares or, female horses that are older, and then make some at-risk situations that might be at risk of going to auction or maybe aren't in the best shape. And we bring them in, get them healthy, and try to find them a forever home. If there's a behavioral or a health situation that we feel would be maybe too hard to place or, dangerous, then the horse will stay here for the duration of its life. So, right now we just have two on those. But it's a smaller farm, so we don't have a whole lot of room. And they're both, one is for sure going to be a lifer. She may go to a therapeutic riding center for the summer. We'll see about that. But the other one has actually a genetic mutation that makes her a little bit, she tends towards aggression if there's any kind of change in her routine. So it's been a learning curve for me because I had never dealt with that before. So it's, I think with horses, which I've been in since I was, 8 years old, the more you learn, the more you realize you have to learn and the more there is to learn. So it's just this constant newness, and challenges, and it keeps it really interesting, frustrating sometimes too, but very educational. They will teach you everything.
That's awesome. So it's got to be spendy to do that. Are you a nonprofit org for bringing in horses it kind of sounds like a rescue situation. So is that what you guys
do? We would like to be. It kind of developed on its own a little bit, and it wasn't something I set out to do. It just kind of happened, I was teaching hunter jumper riders. We were showing the local circuit in the high school in a scholastic circuit, and we had a very large program, and when we moved to Oregon, I had to turn that all over to my partner, and I thought I wanted to teach again out here, but I also had a 3-month-old when we moved, and He was a very needy baby who was not down with mom's attention being divided and did not do babysitters or anyone else besides mom. So
I totally understand.
So it quickly became obvious that I was not going to have a predictable schedule. Mm-hmm. And with lessons, you know, I kind of have to set my kids aside a little bit. They'll watch me teach, but they're not really in it with me quite so much. They might help with jumps or whatever. But with the rescue, they get to participate, you know, and they get to see what taking care of something can do. You know, you have this horse that comes in scared or sick or very depressed, untrusting, and they see it actually, some horses come around pretty quick. Some take longer than others, but just what you can do with love and care and patience. And I think it's a good lesson for them. And I'm happy that they can be a part of it. My daughters mostly, my son who is two is kind of a tornado and mostly just likes to play and hay and, you know, pick up poop and do all those barn things.
Awesome calling that you landed into and that you can incorporate your kids into it. I'm a big animal rescuer. My husband knows that if we had more than an acre, I would be called Noah's Ark. I'd rescue everything I could. We had rescue dogs. One was from the pound. One was from a family that they couldn't home. And she was a little bit on the quirky side, we'll put it that way. And came in with a lot of behavioral things that were a little scary for me. And now she's just an amazing, she's a dog. She loves life. She doesn't have food issues. It's just amazing to be able to be a part like that and see a turnaround. And I'm telling you, if I had land, I would have rescue horses for sure. Cause I am.
Now that I've had it in my yard, I don't think I'll ever go back to boarding. I can adjust diet immediately when I want to. I can just walk outside and there they are. You can't beat it.
Yeah. And for any of my listeners that didn't know this about me, or, you know, I am that country girl deep down, and we did, we did board a horse, and I always felt super guilty because I'd go and work him and be with him every day. And I always felt very guilty because he didn't get to live the life a horse should live out in pasture, you know, and get out. And get
So
I'm really, really glad that you're doing what you're doing. That's awesome. So
thank you. It's fun.
Tell me and the readers, your future readers that are listening to this podcast and they're getting to know you for the first time, tell them what else you would want, something else you would want them to know about you right up front as an author.
Right up front. Right up front as an author, I would say most of us write what we like to read. And I kind of like the darker, twistier puzzle piece type stories, I would say. I mean, Gillian Flynn is like, I feel like I would fall over and die if I ever got to meet her, just because I think that she is a genius when it comes to plot. And if the kind of read that you like is more formula and straightforward, and I don't want to say happily ever after, because I think that happily ever after can come out of dark and twisty and turns and missing pieces. But that I like to explore kind of the gray, because I feel like all of us have darkness in us and all of us have light. And I read something somewhere, I'm probably going to misquote it, but just that the villain isn't bad because he likes to be bad. He's bad because he thinks he's right. And what he thinks is right is wrong for everybody else, but he thinks he's right. And so finding that gray area and the sympathy for the people that you really want to hate, that's what I love to read. And so I think that definitely comes across in how I write as well.
I love it. And I'm so super similar. I typically will start my writing scenes with things that most people wouldn't start with. I like a devastation or a loss or something gray.
Yeah, it's a catalyst.
It's easy for me to start there and work out to how they got to that place and then find them the resolution at the end of maybe happiness, but, you know, not life is always happy.
It's not always happy. It's messy. And
And I love to read those kinds of things too. So fantastic. So Awesome. And hopefully new readers that are listening to your, that are similar and like to read those kind of things will gravitate to your work because, you know, you build on that. So Jada, tell us when you realized you were an author. What was that moment like for you?
I was definitely not the cool kid in school. You know, I was 5'10" at 12 years old and gangly, and I had really bad acne and a fake tooth I could take out on a retainer. That was super cool. And, you know, big frizzy hair and a nerd. God, like, just geeked out over, like, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and kind of very innocent humor that I think my peers had probably moved on from, but I thought it was still really funny. And anyway, so I never really felt like I was supposed to be where I was, if that makes any sense. I didn't feel like the world did not either. I didn't make sense to the world, or the world didn't make sense to me. And I wasn't sure which one it was, but I started reading and I found a home.
Yep.
So I found a place where I belong there. There's a place for me, written for me somewhere that makes me feel like I am supposed to be here. And, I wasn't satisfied with just reading. I started writing too, because I have probably way too vivid of an imagination even still. And I get really lost in my thoughts. And even now at 35, I feel like I have found a home in Southern Oregon. It's quirky. It's quiet. It's beautiful. It's harsh. It's all these things that I see these big green mountains and I feel like I'm home, but my mind and my thoughts still need a place to go. So that to me, I kind of come apart a little bit if I can't get the thoughts out of my head and onto paper. And so, I think that makes me feel like I have to be a writer and I have to be an author no matter what happens from here with it as a career. I will always put them on paper. And I think anyone who writes because they can't stand to not write is a writer. And that's what the definition is to me. But when I felt legit, I guess, the first time I signed a contract, I felt like, you know, oh my gosh, this is it. It's the easy street from here, which is not true. I think that when I felt legit for the first time, I was on an airplane to an event in New York, and there was a lady beside me, and I was on deadline. So I was writing seriously on my laptop. And she looks over and she's like, oh my God, are you an author? And I said, yes. And it was the first time I had said yes. And you could just tell that she felt like writers and authors are, we have this magic in us, or we're tapped into this magic or this beyond that not everybody is. And I don't know if that's true, but it's kind of awesome to think about that we are the kind of the last tangible magic in this world are the people that create. And I will never forget that.
You described the process of realization of creative authorship beautifully. I'm sitting here just going,
thank you.
My mouth is dropped because I asked that question to many authors, almost every author on the podcast, but you're the first person that almost described it to the T of how I feel, except I haven't been published.
I have goosebumps.
Or had somebody ask me if I'm an author yet, but the way you described it being younger and just needing that place and finding that place and reading and then writing is exactly how I felt. So, and feel so beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, it's an anchor for me. It makes me feel like, okay, I'm part of this world because of this.
It is. And,
so,
and
yeah.
For me, it's only really been this last year where this podcast started to get developed for me too. Was I made the conscious choice about a year ago to say it out loud. I'm a writer. I'm an author. Mm-hmm. I haven't published it, but I started to say it. I started to own it and say it to my family and then say it to my friends and then say it on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And then started to ask, you know, and it's just become such a amazing place. I feel like for the first time I found myself, who I'm supposed to be
yeah.
in my skin.
Yeah.
totally exciting. So
it is. Yeah, my daughter was at the dentist yesterday, and you have to fill out your paperwork, and it's like occupation. I was like, I get to write writer. Oh my gosh, you know,
love it.
I love them.
Well, thanks for sharing that, because it just, I'm a little emotional. So you hear the emotion in there, because I connected so much with that part of it. So thanks.
Yeah, you're making me teary.
So let's talk about your publications, what titles you've published, what genre you're in, and you touched just a little bit about signing a contract. So we'll get into the talk about like the publication process for you, but let's start with publication titles and genre.
Okay, sure. It's kind of a fantasy adventure trilogy. It's called the Hightower Trilogy. Book one came out last year, called Wildwood. And book two actually came out 2 days ago, and it's called Windswept. The complication here, and I'm sure we'll dive into this, but the next question is the whole trilogy was actually released several years ago with another publisher, and I decided to part ways and got my rights back, and tried to self-publish and hated it. For me, it was not the right fit. I give many, many accolades to people who do that and do it well, because to me it was too much. I felt lost and overwhelmed and very alone, where when you have a publishing team or the people who self-publish and are clearly establishing teams around them to kind of fill in the gap, I felt like I was drowning. And so I actually reached out to a friend who had just developed her own publishing house called Parliament House Press. And I knew, I'd met her at UtopiaCon in Nashville a couple of years prior, or several years prior. And we sat next to each other at a table. And I contacted her and I said, Shane, you know this story. I know that book one, which was originally titled Moonlit, I know that this something is wrong in this first book. There's something missing. I don't know what it is. It's not right. I had gotten to book three, which is in the series, and it is, to date, the best writing I've ever done was in book three, and I felt like I'd figured a lot out, and I had honed my craft and added tools to my toolbox, and I kind of nailed it, I feel like, in book three. And I look back at book one, and I don't think there's any shame in the first book. You know, I think with any author, you look back and you're like, oh, I probably could have done that different. it was part of the series, and it wasn't just that it was weaker or, not perfect and like that. It was something was wrong with it, and I could not figure out what it was. And so I said, Shane, will you help me tear this whole thing apart, repackage it, rewrite it if I have to, and let's relaunch this together? And she was like, absolutely.
Awesome.
So, so she helped me. She took on the whole series, where actually we've added a fourth book. We're talking about a spinoff series, and we tore the first book apart, and it was brutal. It was so hard. It's coming out, you know, bigger, better, stronger, 2.0, much, much better than before. So I've kind of dabbled in a lot of different aspects of the industry. And now I've forgotten the original question. I'm sorry. I got off on a tangent.
Well, you actually answered a whole bunch of questions, because you just went. I love it. So for me to recap, because the audio is just a hair bit jumbly. So you were with a indie house.
A different publisher.
And then you got your rights back for your
yeah. series,
and then you started self-publication, and you felt overwhelmed. It wasn't a good fit, which I totally get that, because I'm investigating what I want to do, and I lean towards self-publication, but it's a lot of work. And I'm like, I don't know about that.
It's a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah. And then you had a friend that you had met who has her own publishing house, and you guys rewrote, repackaged, and redid your whole series. So I think I got it all. Okay.
Yeah. Good synopsis of the situation.
For some reason, the audio is jumbly. So I'm sorry, podcast listeners. I don't know what's going on, but you know, it is podcasting. So this happens.
Yeah, for sure.
That's part of podcasting at my house. So that's the way it goes. So, awesome. So let's talk. One thing I'm curious about, and I don't know if you can talk about this, but tell me a little bit about what the process was like for you to get your rights back? Did you have to wait a certain amount of time to get out of the contract? Was it, you know, and it was mutual? I mean, I'm curious about that. I have a little bit of history and contractual stuff from my husband's prior work in music, and I know how sticky contracts can be. That's another reason why I'm scared to death to get involved with anything like that, because I'm like, yeah, I've seen those things. They're not great all the time.
Right. No, for sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, I had tried to get an agent, and I think I was rejected 70 something times. And looking back, I can see why, honestly. Mm-hmm. But then with this publisher, and I actually, you know, funny thing, I had two offers on the table. One was they wanted the full manuscript. Mm-hmm. And the other one, they had the full manuscript, and quickly, you know, within a week, they wanted to lock down the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited to get a yes. You know, that feeling of like somebody wants this validation. But I was, you know, I read the contract, but I didn't read it. You know.
There's a lot of legal mumbo jumbo in contracts. And if you've never seen one and you haven't read one, you're almost taken back by some of it. It's like, you don't even know where to start with them.
Yeah. I was way out of my element, and I kind of glaze over when it comes to like all the technical stuff a little bit, you know, and I was like, where do I sign? And so, I learned a lot.
And contracts. So I, you know, there's no dialogue. I'm going to skip over all that.
I don't know, right? Yeah, I'm like, yes, you know, like this is it. Like I've arrived, and I jumped too fast, but in the same token, I learned a lot from them, and I'm not at liberty to say a whole lot, but. I did have legal intervention to regain my rights, I guess, I will say. So it wasn't pretty or smooth or any of those things, but, I learned a lot from them, and they gave me a chance, and I will never begrudge them of that. I am so grateful for that when it came, because at the time, and seeing there, and my oldest daughter was, one, uh-huh. two. So my oldest daughter was two. And I had actually started writing again. I had bits and pieces of it from several years before, but after my oldest daughter was born, and probably before, I had really fallen into this hole, unbeknownst, I'm not sure what the other word is, of some really severe anxiety.
Yeah.
And it got to where, you know, you have a baby and the world gets a lot meaner. You see it and it's sharper and it's, you know, it's harsher and it has pause and peace, and you see the news and it is different.
I remember that very well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I was overtaken by this fear that someone was going to steal my daughter. I mean, I can't even, like, if I went to the store, I was sure someone was there. They wanted to take her. And I can't even explain to you how certain I was. Mm-hmm. So I stopped leaving the house. And for months, I did not leave my house. And finally, my husband and my mom sat me down at the kitchen table, and they were like, this is a problem. This is something going on. And I was like, I'm fine. Like, what are you guys talking about? I am 100% functional. This is an adult right here. You know, like, I'm fine.
It's normal that somebody's going to take my baby that I don't know. I mean, this is totally.
I know, exactly. And so they were like, you're not fine. And so I had to confront, like, I had an issue. And so one thing that I did was, if I was having a thought pattern that seemed irrational, or what I call it, a rabbit hole, where you go in this spiral and suddenly it is spinning faster and faster and you're plummeting and it's so dark and can't breathe, and I have to tell my husband, this is a thought that I'm having. Is this a normal thought? Yeah. Is this, would you have this thought in this situation? And one of the things that I did to kind of retrain my brain and to help, you know, find the floor of the rabbit hole before you're 3,000 feet under is I started writing again, and I needed a world I could control. Yeah. You know, or I was like, I can, if I want to hang up the bad guy, you know, by his toes, I get to do that because this is my world.
Yep.
And
yep.
that's, yeah. So that's how I clawed out of that. And it's, I think it's still something even now, like that I feel like I'm on top of it. And then every now and then I get really nervous for absolutely no reason.
Yep. Exactly.
And I'm like, let me just go right. Like, let me go. Mm-hmm. Let me go get control of this brain.
Yeah, I totally understand that. And I found with myself a lot of moments when I am the most distressed over situations that I can't control. That's when mm-hmm. some of the best work, my writing work, comes out of it, because I can control the world that I'm writing. I'll give one example, and see, people haven't read my work yet, so they don't know this to be true about me, but my family does. So I had a very wonderful situation at a work environment, and I had an amazing mentor, loved him to death, and he just quickly changed jobs, went somewhere else, and I wasn't prepared for the switch of having my mentor go somewhere else. And I was devastated after he told me, just totally devastated. I really felt a huge loss. In my working mm-hmm. environment. And I was starting to shut down from just emotions from everybody and everything. And it took me about a week to realize I needed to write. I needed to get back into writing, because at that point I wasn't writing anything at all, period.
Yeah.
So then what I ended up doing was I went and grabbed my computer, my laptop, and I started to rewrite some stories that I was working on. That helped me reframe and rediscover, you know, first that I was strong enough to live out this experience, because for me, mentors and having good mentors is really important to me in my life. And having the situation where it was out of the blue, he's leaving, kind of gone thing, it just threw me for a loop. So I was able to create an amazing story around the similar experience, but the person, she felt strong in that story. And I was like, okay, if I can write that, then I can believe that. And I can.
Yeah. Right? Definitely.
Yeah. And that's happened to me. I've always kept journals, and journals are so important to me to keep. And I find that I write the most of my journals under emotional distress. It's not when I'm the when I'm the happiest in life, I'm not necessarily writing very much.
I completely agree. Yeah. No, with the horses, they're like my counterbalance. And so if I'm like happy and I need physical activity too, to kind of keep my brain in check. And so I'll be outside in the garden or working a horse or, you know, dragging the ring. And then when I'm agitated, I need to sit down and write.
Yep. And here in the Pacific Northwest, people don't know this. I like to let everybody know that the Pacific Northwest is beautiful in the summer for about 2.5-3 months. I'm not writing very much during that time, because the sun and the sunshine and the garden and everything, you know, fulfills me. But then when those winter months and the gray comes in, that's when I'm most productive, because I'm inside and it's gray and I'm sad. And so I can write really well. I think that's why we have so many great writers in the Pacific Northwest. Long months of gray.
Well, and it took me some getting used to, because I've lived kind of all over, but was born and raised in Georgia. And that first winter here, I don't know how it was in Washington, but in Southern Oregon, it rained for 100 days straight.
Oh yeah.
And then we had 3.5 feet of snowfall from the sky in like 2 or 3 days. And I was like, what is this? And I heard a great quote, a friend of mine put it up, and it's no flower blooms all year. And so I realized spring and summer is for my horses and winter is for my riding. And I can split it up that way. Yep. And it works.
And it's true. And I'm writing right now. It's right now while we're recording this, we're in the middle of May. When you listeners hear this, it'll probably be June or July before you get this one out, because I have that many podcast recordings, which is awesome. But writing a blog about a process for me as being content in the place that I've been born. I'm not born here, but raised here in this small town my whole life. And I've always not been content. I've wanted to leave, mm-hmm. go to Seattle, go to Portland, go somewhere glamorous and fun. And this year I just realized that I needed to be happy with where I'm at. And when I embraced that, then everything opened up for me. And I'm calling this month's blog Bloom Where You're planted based on a flower thing that I saw. And it's around the aspect of gardening too, in the sense that we need pruning and we need, there's long winters, but those winters help to make the beautiful summer gardens gorgeous. So that's kind of the process I'm going through on that blog, because it's so true. We live in seasons of our lives as writers and as so. Awesome. So let's jump into one other question, and then I want you to read your story for our listeners, because our listeners get to listen to us ramble, and what they really want to hear is your story. So so you're very inspiring to me, so listening to you, Jada, so I hope you know that. I just feel like we've become kindred spirits over the podcast phone.
I feel that way.
but why don't you share with me and the listeners what your inspiration is for writing? You kind of touched on it just a little bit, but do you have one specific thing that really truly is your inspiration?
I saw something that said, be who you needed when you were younger. It took me a long time, and I think it's probably true for everybody, and it's a process and it's constantly changing, but it took me a long time to not just figure out who I was, but kind of touching on what you said earlier, to own it and to not apologize for it.
Exactly.
And to be who you are and don't flinch. You know, like, it's the world needs you. You're supposed to be here. And you're supposed to be here exactly as you are. And what I am inspired to do is I want to write the books I needed when I was younger, or to give to someone like me who is sitting alone in a cafeteria and feels like there is no place for him or her in their current environment. And they open a book and they say, I belong somewhere. It might not be right here, it might not be right now, but I belong somewhere. Mm-hmm. And just to be true to who you are and know that it is exactly okay. And kind of finding the books, I feel like, and I don't know if it's because I'm an 80s kid, so to age myself a little bit.
That's okay.
I feel like, we're coming out of the recession, and it was kind of this idea of go to college and then leap and land on your silver pad and climb that golden ladder and make sure you have your golden suit. And it was this idea of landing and not this idea of building.
Yeah.
And so, I'm got off on another tangent, but
okay. I like your tangent.
Realizing that there are so many steps between where you are now and where you're going to be, and you don't know where you're going to be, and where you are now is awesome. So, and it's okay to embrace where you are and what you're doing, and that life is messy, circling back to what we talked about, and that there's so much beauty in a mess. And I think being inspired by the storm and being inspired by the mess and looking back on your life and seeing how things are connected and seeing bullets you dodged that you never saw coming because you didn't have to, because you dodged them by some miracle. And those kinds of things inspire me so much. It's a gorgeous day or a crazy storm, and I just think, what? I get really existential, I'm like, are we even all really here? But just kind of realizing how small and how big you are, and that one decision, one tiny decision, can echo forever.
Yeah.
And that creeps me out, but it's also really, really inspiring to me.
Awesome. I love it. I love your inspiration. I love the idea of being that person that you needed as a young person, as a young person. Because honestly, we all needed somebody. We needed, we were fantastic, and that we're going to make it through, right? That's the thing. And I tell my daughters this, they're older, but it's the one thing, the message I hope that they always will remember of me saying is, you're going to make it. This is only passing.
Yeah, you're going to be okay.
Awesome. Well, let's set the stage for your reading, because I'm so excited to hear it. So give us a little bit of what you can about the setting, characters, backgrounds to set up the reading so we can fall right into the reading with you and understand what's going on. And then go ahead and read.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to read from Wildwood. It's book one. And Tangie Hightower is my main character. She has grown up in the horse world. Her dad runs Wildwood Farm. And, you know, she wants to follow in his footsteps, and she thinks she wants to go ride pro or, possibly, you know, be an apprentice for a trainer. She's not really sure. And on her 18th birthday, her mother warns them as they walk out the door to not deviate from tradition. And, her mother's a little bit of an odd bird. She has to watch every sunrise. It's like her religion. And, you know, Tansy kind of like takes it with a grain of salt, but, it kind of sticks with her that her mom said that. And they do deviate from tradition, and they go on a trail ride. And her, because of a situation that happens, her father's horse spooks, and her father and his horse go into a river. And her father is not found. And it's where I'm going to read from is a year later. It's the eve of her 19th birthday. And so the last year has kind of shown the effects of her father's death, essentially, even though they've never found the body, on her mother, on her, on their relationship, on her future, because, you know, she, after she graduated, she didn't go to college and didn't pursue a career because she felt like she had to stay home, of course, to help her mom. And I think sometimes when you have that kind of catastrophe happen, the idea of leaving the scene is unfathomable. Like, you have to stay. Like, it roots you to the spot a little bit sometimes. And that has definitely been true for Tansy and her mom. And one of their traditions is making coconut pancakes. Her mother's a terrible cook and usually burns them. So Tansy Hightower is now working at a barbecue restaurant called Smokey's and trying to keep the lights on in their house. And the chapter begins the eve of her 19th birthday, when she comes home determined that nothing will go wrong. So I will start. I stand in the express checkout aisle at the grocery store, wondering if the cashier can smell the sickeningly sweet scent of barbecue sauce clinging to my clothes and my hair. Coconut pancakes, I'm guessing, she asks, scanning the shredded coconut, the box of instant pancake mix, and a bottle of whipped cream. I've never thought to make them with coconut. Family tradition. I'll have to try that sometime, she says, and I manage a tight smile as I hand her the cash. I'm pretty sure it still smells like Smokies, too. I bag my groceries and head home. The sun has already sunk behind the trees. I'd hoped to be home with Mom before dark, but Smokies had been busy today, and another server had called out sick. The house is dark as night. I tiptoe into the kitchen and set out the ingredients and the griddle. Then I climb on a chair and take the smoke detector off the ceiling. For added measure, I remove all the smoke detectors on the first floor. Tomorrow, my mom will cook coconut pancakes, and nothing will go wrong. I crack my mom's door open, making sure she's home. She's fast asleep. Lately, her days seem to be divided into fourths. She sleeps part of the night and part of the day. She spends most mornings in the backyard, regardless of the weather. She spends the middle of the night roaming the house, tracing a clockwise pattern around the first floor. Sometimes I lie awake at night and try to track her feather-light footsteps as she moves from room to room, wondering what she's looking for. I find myself tiptoeing to the living room, sitting in Dad's favorite chair, wrapped in his tattered gray quilt, staring at the last picture ever taken of my father. It sits on the mantel in a plain silver frame that I've never liked. I take down the frame and pull off the back, removing the picture. Then I take it to my room and curl up with this blue plaid shirt I stole the day Mom made a blanket out of him. His picture shakes so hard in my hand, I'm afraid I'll tear it. I put it down on the bedside table, but it feels too far away, so I pick it up again. I don't tremble as hard if I don't look at it. Tonight, for the first time in almost a year, the ghost of him feels like it's everywhere. I saw him all day at the restaurant, and again at a stoplight on the way to the store. I ball his shirt in my fist and press it against my mouth to keep from crying. Mom will be up soon, and I don't want her to hear me. The moon passes across the width of my window. Mom hasn't started walking. Something's wrong. I creep to the top of the stairs. The bottom floor is dark. The steps creak under my weight. I expect her to come around a corner at any moment, and I wonder if she'll even notice I'm here. I peek down her hall. Her door is closed. I open it. Her bed is empty, and the window is open. She's in the yard in a nightgown, her whole being turned silver by the moon. She's holding a shovel, digging a huge hole where the tulip once grew. There's a mound of dirt behind it. She steps into the hole and disappears up to her thighs. She climbs back out, walks the perimeter, and continues to shovel. Despair seeps through me. Mom's had a run of bad days lately, but this is the strangest thing she's done in a long time. I wonder if she's been seeing the psychic again. I've started scanning the phone bill each month for commercial phone numbers, but haven't seen any. I expected the spectrum of her moods to consolidate, when really it's only widened. A few of her good days have nearly bordered who she was before Dad vanished, but her bad days have only intensified with time. I start to call out to her through the window when clouds pass over the moon, snuffing out the faint light. The darkness around her begins to thicken and crackle. She doesn't look up, doesn't notice the static glow or the fizzing sound. I hold my breath. Silver fissures spiderweb across the black. Still, she doesn't acknowledge them. Are they real? Is any of it? Is my mother really standing outside in a slip of a gown during the first frost of fall, digging a hole big enough to fit a body? Or am I imagining all of it? Is she sound asleep in her bed or pacing the house and I can't see her? What if I'm not watching her lose her mind? What if it's me? I reach for her bed and run my hand over the comforter. It's flat and cool. I turn back to the window. The cyclone of shadows has vanished. The dark blanket of night returns. Mom goes still. Her head swivels in my direction and I duck out of sight. I hurry from her room, easing her door shut behind me, and then continue down the hall and into the kitchen. The clock on the stove reads 3 a.m. I lean on the counter, gripping the egg to keep my hands from trembling. Nausea churns so hard in my stomach I can barely breathe or swallow. What is happening to me? I can barely remember who I was on this day last year. She's a stranger now. What did I want back then? Where did I think I would be today? All I can remember is promising Mom I'd come home. No matter how hard I try to stop it, my mind replays the ride to the ridge, shows me the iridescent rainbow shimmering across the valley and the flash of blue. Even now, my voice trumpets in my ears. A wave of guilt strikes me center and I nearly gag. I need proof. I need to know if she sees the shadows, if she reads them the way she reads the sunrise. I slip through the back door and step out onto the lawn, which is icy and brittle under my bare feet. The mound of dirt she's made is gone. She must have refilled the hole. I walk to the side, waiting to feel the soft, loose place of freshly turned earth, but I can't find it. I crisscross the yard until I'm dizzy. There's no break in the terrain. I swear, I murmur, turning in a circle. I clamp my hands on both sides of my head as a buzz grows in my ears. This doesn't make any sense. Had I imagined it? Has a year of nearly sleepless nights finally caught up with me? Confusion swirls inside my skull. I hurry into the house and traipse down the hall, leaving a trail of dirty footprints. I reach up to knock on her door when the sound of her sobbing comes through the wood. All thoughts of what I saw outside vanish. This conversation will happen, it must, but it can wait one more day. Mama, are you okay? Just leave me be, Tansy. Her voice is thick and blubbery. I brought stuff for coconut pancakes, I say. We can make them together. Not today. Grief pricks my heart. But it's tradition. To hell with tradition. It couldn't keep any of you safe. She lets out a jagged sob. Safe from what? I press my ear against the door. From the darkness in the world, Tansy, from all of it. Please, Mom, let's make the pancakes and we can go to Wildwood, just like me and Dad did every year. I can take you to the ridge. We can just walk. We won't ride. He was so happy up there, Mom. Maybe you'll feel it. Maybe you'll feel him. I rest my forehead on the door. My fingers wrap around the handle, testing it. She didn't lock it. I slowly turn it, easing the door open. Mom is sitting on her bed, a bottle of bourbon in her hand. Where did you get that? I ask, alarmed. I'd poured out all the bottles I could find after the psychic's first and only visit. That's not your business. She stands up and sways to the side. This is my business. I help pay bills. I put food in the kitchen. I've given up everything for you. College, writing, Wildwood, everything. I'm trying to help you, but I can't do that if you won't help yourself. Help me. It should have been you that day. Don't you get that? It should have been you in that river. I stumble away from her, my ears ringing, my heart shuddering in my chest. How could you? How could you say that? I whisper. How could you say that to me? Pansy, no. Her face sags and her mouth hangs open. I didn't mean it like that. And how else did you mean it? I ask, gasping. I meant. My heart quakes in my chest. I spin in my heels and run to the door, grabbing the keys on my way out. She's still shouting my name when I fling open the front door. I jump in Dad's truck. I can't drive away fast enough. Sheets of rain collide with the windshield. Between the rain, the dark, the pops of lightning, and the halo from the headlights, I can barely see the front of the truck. I don't even know where I'm going, just somewhere that isn't home. I grip the steering wheel. My mind spins. My breathing sounds far away. Memories from the last year fill the narrow cab. Mom ranting, pacing, blind to my presence. The first time I noticed the bills were past due, and the electricity was 2 days away from being turned off. Mom staring out the window, her silence louder than her scream, watching the tulip's roots shrivel and the slender stem wither. The time I found Mom's wedding dress, still stained with dirt, stuffed in the fireplace. The hundreds of dinners I've eaten alone. 15 seconds of dread I feel between exiting my truck and reaching the front door of my own house every time I come home. I can't do it anymore. Tears streak down my face. The turn for Wildwood appears. I wait for the customary nudge of guilt, which has stalled my truck 20 feet from here more times than I can count, but it doesn't come. I steer down Wildwood's driveway, my mind becoming quieter the closer I am to the parking lot. With a start, I realize I've pulled into Dad's old parking spot. I lean against the chair and inhale. I feel his presence more here already than I have anywhere else in the past year. I hop out of the truck and jog to the doorway, only now realizing I'm still in my pajamas. I pluck the spare key from the garage door track and unlock Dana's office, where her farm jacket will be waiting on the back of her desk chair, the way Dad's used to. It's a tradition I'm glad she kept, especially tonight. I shrug on her jacket, pull on a spare ball cap hanging off her bulletin board, grab a couple brushes out of the basket for lesson supplies, and head to Harbor's stall. Her head is sticking over the Dutch door as if she knows I'm here. She whinnies when she sees me. Hey, girl. Emotion squeezes my throat. I've only seen her twice in a year, and she's not holding it against me. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. New tears come flooding my eyes. I drop the brushes in the barn aisle, butt myself into her stall, and sob into her neck. She nuzzles my hair in my side. Her warm breath works to thaw my heart, still frozen by my mother's words. I have given up so much to be by her side, including Harbor, but it wasn't enough. She wishes the river had taken me instead of Dad. It should have been you. I sob, sinking to my knees. Maybe I should have left for college. Maybe without me around, she would have found more peace. I have never considered she saw Dad's accident as some kind of choice, an either or. Peace spooked. Dad could have jumped off. He didn't. Why didn't you just jump off? I whisper. Harbor drops her head to sniff my cheek. I touch her face and she noses at my fingers. When's the last time Mom reached out for me? When's the last time she asked me if I'm okay? I'm not okay. A clap of close thunder startles Harbor and she moves into me. It's okay, girl. It's just a storm, I murmur. Her nostrils flare. She steps to her stall door and peers out. Footsteps echo down the hall. They're too slow to be Dana. I glance down where my watch should be, but I've taken it off before bed. Is it already time to feed? I back against the front wall and sink down between Harbor's two hanging water buckets. A man's silhouette appears in the opening, backlit by the hall light. Is someone in here? He asks. He bends down. When he straightens up, I see he's holding the two brushes I dropped in the aisle. Hey, girl, he says. I hold my breath, wondering if I've been spotted. Instead, he reaches in and scratches Harbor behind the ear. She shoves her nose into his chest. I lean forward, disbelieving. Harbor bites everyone but me. The man's face shifts, looking into the stall, and we lock eyes. What are you doing in here? He asks, sliding the bolt on the door. Light spills onto his face, revealing two scars that run from his jaw to where his ear connects to the side of his face. Familiarity knits at the base of my neck. Where have I seen this guy before? This is my horse. I jump to my feet. I know, he smiles. You know. Everyone knows who you are. And from what I've heard, the only people Harbor will let hang out in her stall without trying to kick their teeth in are me and you. I've been watching out for her since you've been gone. I hope that's okay. What are you doing here? It's really late. I press myself against Harbor's shoulder. The storm is about to get really bad. He glances down the aisle. The radar is lit up like the 4th of July. I couldn't sleep. I figured I'd rather be here than stare at my ceiling. So you work here? I'm Lucas. He sticks his hand over the barn door. I keep mine where they are. That's fair, he responds and withdraws his hand. Dana lets you come to the barn whenever you feel like it, I ask. You're here too, he raises his brow. Yeah, but my dad... I trail off, suddenly overcome. My dad used to run this place. From what I understand, it's more like your dad was this place. All I hear is how Wildwoods isn't the same without him. How could it be? A gust of wind rips through the barn and blows rain harder against the metal roof. My mind drifts to the river, and I imagine how fast it's rising. Were you planning on grooming her? He asks, holding out the brushes. My attack locker is down the hall. I'll go get my stuff in a bit, I lie. I stay behind the security at the door, wishing Harbor hadn't taken a liking to this guy. He has to duck to fit inside the door. His eyes are wide set and almost completely black. His gray shirt is tucked into a pair of jeans, and his boots are caked with mud. My gaze travels back to the scars on his face. For some reason, I know if I check his hands, I'll find more. I know I've seen him before, but it's a small town, and Smokey's is a local favorite. He's probably been in the diner at least once in the past 5 months. Maybe he even sat in my section. Didn't you want to get your brushes? He gestures down the hall toward the line of tack lockers and then slowly looks back at me. I'm freaking you out, aren't I? He asks. He steps back and lifts his hands. Say no more. I want to check the radar again anyway. I'll sack out in Dana's office. It won't be the first night I've spent on that futon. You won't even know I'm there. Thanks. Be seeing you, he says, and retracts his looming body from the doorway. I replay his words in my head, and recognition jolts through me. Not what he said, but his voice. Are you okay, miss? He was at my graduation. Hey, wait, I blurt. He doesn't answer. I don't know why I need to know why he was at graduation. Maybe he was there for a relative. Or maybe he's why Dana needed to drop by Wildwood before lunch. Maybe because it was the first time someone had asked me if I was okay in months. But something inside of me needs to know. Lucas! I peer around the doorframe and into the barn aisle. He's gone. I walk out of Harbor's stall. Dana's office door is open. I jog down the hall. He's not there. I head to the parking lot. Except for my truck, the lot is empty. I stop in my tracks. Lucas's boots have been caked in mud, as if he'd walked straight out of the pasture. Purple lightning forks across the sky, followed immediately by a crack of thunder. Two more bolts split the dark in rapid succession. A fourth hits so close the air crackles in the aftermath. Each time the lightning flashes, the woods light up in silvers and blues, and the shadows dance and leap. A sharp creak is followed by the bang of wood on wood. Someone's stall door has opened hard and fast. I lean forward in time to see Harbor emerge from her open stall. She holds her silver head high, stepping with caution, and then takes off down the aisle at a trot. I must have left her stall door open. Harbor, I hiss at her. Whoa, girl. One ear swivels in my direction, and her body curls in consideration. Then her back hoof knocks an overturned bucket, sending it clattering to the side, and she bolts out of the barn. Lucas, Harbor's loose, I shout over my shoulder, and then follow her into the storm. And that's the end of the chapter.
Awesome. I'm so hooked. I gotta know what's going on. So I'm gonna have to... No, very good. Very impactful, catching emotions. I love it. You did wonderful, Dana, in this book. So
Thank you, listeners,
if you loved it too, make sure you go to Jada's website, and I'll put all that in show notes so you can find her and get her book. And if you read it, write a review for her. And thanks so much for being here. And I'm sure that in the future, we'll have you back.
Oh, I would love to come back. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. We hoped you loved hearing from the author as much as we did. If you did enjoy the author, make sure you find them on social media. Buy their book and write a review. Are you a published author and would like to be featured on the podcast? Visit us at our website to learn more. You can help support the production of this podcast by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Share the podcast with your friends. And most importantly, become a supporter. Supporters receive monthly bonus podcasts and a newsletter filled with tips from our authors. To find out more how to become a supporter, visit our website. And finally, I hope you always remember to enjoy the journey. Until next week, this is Vicki J. Carter saying goodbye.